welcome to the Business Standard Morning Show. I'm Nazia Iqbal, and here's a look at the stories for the day. Sales of passenger vehicles set a fresh record last year with more than 3.8 million units rolling out of showrooms. And out of it, the share of SUVs was over 42%. The mightier SUV overtook its humble rival, the hatchback, for the first time in 2022. The just-concluded Auto Expo in Greater Noida also reflected the mood on the streets. So why have SUVs become the first choice of most Indian families? Debagya Sanyal's report gives an overview.
The display floor of Auto Expo 2023 somewhat reflected the mood on the Indian streets. SUVs were the showstoppers here as well, with 10 new launches, including EVs and EV concepts in the SUV or SUV coupe form. Automakers are racing to fulfill the growing appetite of Indian consumers for large, family-sized vehicles. From the Grand Vitara-sized EVX concept to the all-new Fronx YTB crossover and the five-door Jimny, the country's largest car maker Maruti Suzuki has finally put its SUV project in the top gear. Other major brands have already taken advantage of this SUV craze. Most major OEMs, including Lexus, MG, Kia, and Tata, led their major car launches with SUVs. Auto manufacturers unveiled a flock of new models across price ranges and engine variants. Kia, for instance, showcased its futuristic EV9, an electric SUV concept based on eGMP architecture, which is set to make its debut by the end of 2023. Hyundai's IONIQ 5 is also an electric SUV with a 72.6 kWh battery, a driving range up to 631 km on a full charge, and a starting price of Rs 44.95 lakhs. Tata, which leads the passenger EV sector with more than 80% market share, unveiled 12 new vehicles, including the Sierra electric SUV concept, the SUV coupe Tata Curve, and a facelift and update on the Tata Harrier. The Curve concept will be first built as an EV before the ICE or internal combustion engine variant hits the market, while the Sierra concept, unlike the older Sierra, will have a five-door SUV setup. Lexus too had its flagship SUV, the LX500D. It also launched Lexus RX in India. MG led with EHS, a mid-sized SUV, while also presenting a facelifted Hector. These were besides the several updated and facelifted offerings of Toyota and other brands. So, why are an increasing number of SUVs entering Indian homes?
OEMs sell what a customer wants, right? And then from that perspective, the customer demand for SUVs, to my mind, is for two big factors. Factor number one, Indian families like to travel together. SUVs offer them cabin space for them to travel more comfortably, maybe have an extra member travel along with them, more headroom space. So, that whole concept of the Indian family moving together suits better towards an SUV. And the second biggest factor to my mind is our roads, right? The condition of roads is not the best in most of the places. And an SUV, because of the height that it has, the car doesn't hit the ground. It's a little more comfortable driving for the people sitting on the back seat, etc.
A taller driving stance, more upright and commanding road presence, larger tires, flexibility and maximization of space are some of the factors that explain the rise of the SUVs. The elevated driving position gives better control to the drivers, while the higher ground clearance lets the driver negotiate Indian roads better. The former Director General of the Society of Indian Automobile Manufacturers, Dilip Chinoy, explains.
The SUV today gives you the same riding comfort and facilities as a sedan did. Earlier, the SUVs were not as comfortable or as fully loaded as the sedans were. Second, if you look at today's SUVs, you're getting a lot of variations of hybrids, mild hybrids, and also other powered vehicles, which give you significantly higher mileage than what they gave earlier. The third is, you know, the SUVs have greater space inside. They have a greater road presence and are also, you know, higher ground clearance there. And therefore, there are much preferred vehicles in Indian road conditions.
Nandeep Vaidya, an associate professor at the NMIMS Anil Surendra Modi School of Commerce, however, highlights the possible challenges and measures needed to sustain the boom in SUV consumption.
Now, there is no major downside to this, but there are certainly some challenges which one may want to consider. And since they are wider vehicles and bigger vehicles, particularly in the larger cities, metros, you have challenges for parking, you have challenges for maneuvering vehicles. And therefore, to that extent, you have to overcome that by, you know, a better infrastructure on the road to handle these vehicles. Secondly, the vehicles have to be sturdy enough to withstand the road conditions. And thirdly, they have to meet the environment norms, as are called for globally. Therefore, the EV part, which also is heartening, that a lot of EV launches are happening in this segment.
Chinoy disagrees, though.
The SUVs actually, they are in length shorter than the sedan. And I don't think there is a challenge with the infrastructure. The Indian infrastructure, road infrastructure, is growing tremendously. Within cities where there is high density of cars, etc., between an SUV and a sedan, you know, the choice is, the road congestion is not significantly different. So I think the infrastructure would be sufficient for this.
Experts believe that SUVs are likely to dominate the Indian roads in the days to come. Equipment manufacturers are also warming up to the full magnitude of SUVs' rise. However, they do believe that a faster adoption of EVs into this segment will be key to the long life of SUVs on the Indian roads.
While India's auto sales reflected the country's booming economy, those of Pakistan's revealed a lot about its uncertain future. Car sales in Pakistan had dropped by 51% in Q1 FY23. An IMF report also said this week that Pakistan is South Asia's weakest economy. Amid this turmoil, the country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has stepped up overtures to India. In a recent interview, Sharif has asked Prime Minister Narendra Modi to come to the table for talks. How should India respond? Here's Bhashwar Kumar's report.
Pakistan has learned its lesson. We had three wars with India. Three. And the consequence of those wars, as a result, it only brought more miseries, unemployment,
to nations,
poverty, and millions were demoted from their level of satisfaction to a lower level of satisfaction. We have learned our lesson, and we want to live in peace with India, provided we are able to resolve our genuine problems.
Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif made this startling admission during an interview given to the Al Arabiya news channel. In the interview, which took place during his recent visit to the United Arab Emirates, Sharif also said that he had sought Emirati President Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan's intervention in facilitating talks with India. He asserted that Pakistan had learnt its lessons and was ready for sincere talks with India.
So, my message to the Indian leadership and Prime Minister Modi is that let's sit down on the table and have serious and sincere talks to resolve our burning issues like Kashmir.
Sharif also made a direct appeal to Prime Minister Narendra Modi, asking him to come to the table for talks. The interview was telecast by Pakistan's state-run TV. But just hours later, Sharif's office issued a statement saying that any dialogue with New Delhi is not possible till it takes back its August 2019 decision of revoking the special status given to Jammu and Kashmir. On the 5th of August 2019, the Indian government had revoked the special status or autonomy given under Article 370 of the Constitution to Jammu and Kashmir, and the state was bifurcated into two union territories, Jammu and Kashmir and Ladakh. Sharif met UAE President Al Nahyan on the 12th of January in Abu Dhabi during a two-day visit, which was focused on promoting UAE-Pakistan economic ties. Despite Sharif's emphasis on Kashmir, which Pakistan considers to be its principal dispute with India and a crucial part of any dialogue with the latter, the word Kashmir itself was conspicuously absent from the UAE-Pakistan joint statement issued at the end of his visit. The growing warmth in India-UAE ties, as evidenced by the India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement that entered into force in May 2022, may be the reason behind Sharif's belief that the leadership of the United Arab Emirates can facilitate talks with India. Sharif's statement comes at a time when Pakistan is facing a multidimensional crisis. There is ongoing political instability brought on by the tussle between former Pakistani PM Imran Khan and the Sharif government. Pakistan's economy is also teetering on collapse, with inflation at decades high levels and the Pakistani rupee plummeting. Islamabad's list of economic woes is lengthy, to say the least, from a significant shortage of energy to its foreign exchange reserves standing at dangerously low levels. In fact, its reserves cannot cover even 1 month of average imports. Meanwhile, increasing food and fuel prices have led to a cost of living crisis. The floods of 2022, which destroyed critical infrastructure and left millions displaced, have sent Pakistan's already faltering economy into a tailspin. Pakistan had entered a $6 billion IMF program in 2019. The program amount was increased to $7 billion in 2022. But its ninth review had been put off due to the Pakistani government's unwillingness to accept certain conditions placed by the IMF. The disagreements between the fund and Islamabad have not been resolved yet. Pakistan needs to complete the delayed ninth review for the release of $1.18 billion. Meanwhile, Islamabad has also reached out to friendly nations for financial assistance, with some success. Overall, while it may have averted a sovereign default for now, Pakistan's challenges are significant. The Pakistani establishment's ties with the Taliban government in Afghanistan have also come under pressure amid violent clashes at the border. There has also been a spurt in terrorist attacks in the border region of Pakistan, which experts believe are being carried out by the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan. According to Pakistan's media, the TTP executed over 100 attacks in 2022. Amid these mounting troubles, Sharif, and perhaps even the real center of power in Pakistan, its armed forces, may have good reason to seek talks with India. But how should India react given its past experiences? After all, the Kargil War of 1999 followed close on the heels of the then Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee's visit to Pakistan.
India should not react at all because it is a non-offer, it's a non-starter. It is typical Pakistani speak, as far as I am concerned, with the fork tongue and trying to be clever by the half. I don't know whether Pakistan has learned any lessons, as the Prime Minister claims, but India has certainly learned a lesson that Pakistan is a dysfunctional state and it's very difficult for them to mend its ways. Prime Minister Sharif, he's skating on thin ice. He's not an elected Prime Minister, but a selected Prime Minister. Imran Khan is snapping on his heels. The army, he's at the army's sufferance. The economy is in a free fall. Now look at the so-called offer. It is not meant for India. It is just meant for the Arab world and the international community. It will take a lot more than just words for India to understand that Pakistan means business.
After the remarks made by Shahbaz Sharif, there has been a clarification issued by the Prime Minister's office that dialogue can only follow the reversal of the decision taken for changing the status of Jammu and Kashmir. So if that conditionality has now been introduced again, then what are the prospects for a dialogue? I mean, how do we respond? Because it would really seem that there is a conditional offer. I cannot see that the government of India is going to be ready to discuss the reversal of the change in the status of Jammu and Kashmir.
If talks are not an option for India at the moment, then the key question that remains is how New Delhi should manage its relationship with Islamabad going ahead.
I would suspect that what has already been happening over the last couple of years, which is some kind of, if not back-channel talks, at least some engagement between the national security establishments of the two countries to essentially ensure that a degree of peace and tranquility is maintained on the borders. And that has been achieved. So I think the stalemate which we are in today will probably continue. Let me conclude by saying I cannot see, India being able to play a major regional role or a global role without having a very sound South Asia policy. And that South Asia policy cannot exclude Pakistan. So even though it is very complex, it is very difficult. But yes, I think we should try to find a way of remaining engaged with Pakistan. Also, keep open the door for Pakistan to once again join us together in following some kind of a regional integration policy for the subcontinent.
At present, relations with Pakistan are reasonably stable, but at a very low plateau. Very low plateau indeed. You do not have high commissioners in place, there is no trade, and there's virtually a freeze on people moving from one country to the other, and virtually non-existent cultural relations. So only the bare bones of a diplomatic relationship exists. Can something be done about this quickly? Perhaps not, because there is a internal churn in Pakistan, and there's no clear direction or no clear estimation can be made of what trajectory Pakistan will follow. India-Pakistan relations have never followed a linear pattern. They are highly susceptible to political initiatives. Perhaps in the medium term, once there is greater political clarity in Pakistan, you may see other steps being taken.
There seems to be little incentive for the government in India to engage in talks with Pakistan in the immediate future, especially with the Lok Sabha elections due in 2024. However, with South Asia being one of the least integrated regions of the world and intra-regional trade accounting for around 5% of the total trade of its countries, greater engagement between India and Pakistan may prove to be crucial for the region's long-term prosperity.
Meanwhile, India continued to make big strides towards a better future. The government recently approved the Green Hydrogen Mission with an initial outlay of 19,744 crore rupees to fast-track India's transition to clean energy. The Green Hydrogen Focus has encouraged participation from India's largest corporate houses. So which related stocks should be on your radar? Harshita Singh answers in our next segment. The government's National Green Hydrogen Mission is expected to give a fillip to India's domestic renewable energy sector by significantly cutting the cost of green hydrogen. The fall in its cost, analysts say, will help it replace the widely used grey hydrogen produced from fossil fuels.
Currently, many industries use the grey hydrogen, which is produced from fossil fuel and costs much less than green hydrogen, which is produced from renewable energy. In rupee terms, despite the rising gas prices, the cost of producing grey hydrogen is in the region of about 160 to 220 rupees, whereas the production of green hydrogen was closer to rupees 500 per kg. But now with the new policy, green hydrogen production will get open access without central surcharge and zero interstate transmission charges for 25 years. So the cost can actually drop about 50%. On top of that, an incentive of rupees 50 per kg will bring the costs closer to grey hydrogen. If it works out well, India could be among the leading green hydrogen players by 2050 with a $340 billion market. The listed entities which may directly be associated with the green hydrogen production would be Reliance Industries, L&T, NTPC, GAIL and IOC.
The policy also focuses on manufacturing electrolyzers, which is a key component in making green hydrogen. Companies that will benefit from the policy include electrolyzer manufacturers, hydrogen fuel cell makers for non-emission vehicles, and those engaged in energy storage solutions, as per experts. The government expects the price of the green fuel to fall to $1 per kg by 2030 from the current $4 to $5 per kg. This, analysts say, will enable healthy margins for refinery companies that remain top users of green hydrogen. Nuvama Institutional Equities expects Reliance Industries and Adani Group to be other key gainers given their massive clean energy investments. RIL, as part of its 75,000 crore rupees green investment push, is in a pact with Denmark's Seasdel to make electrolyzers. Adani Group, meanwhile, has also laid out an investment plan of $50 billion with France-based Total Energies SE to produce green hydrogen over the next 10 years. Analysts at Jefferies estimate a $74 billion market for Reliance electrolyzer business by 2030. Moreover, they have valued the conglomerate's green hydrogen business at $8 billion, raising the base case target on the stock to 3,100 rupees. NTPC remains another preferred bet, which is currently implementing several green hydrogen production projects. CLSA has a target price of 188 rupees on the stock, as it believes NTPC is a key play on India's entry into the global green hydrogen space. CLSA says, "We expect NTPC to secure 15% of the domestic green hydrogen market by FY32. This business could add 155 billion rupees to its revenue and 58 billion rupees to its EBITDA by FY32, with an upside of 14.4 rupees per share or 9% to its current market price. Other players that are set to benefit from the green hydrogen push include oil marketing companies Adani Green, Tata Power and Sterling and Wilson Renewable Energy, as per analyst at Nuvama Institutional Equities. That said, equity market action today will be guided by Q3 earnings of HUL, Asian Paints, PVR, Havells and Emphasis, among others. From markets, let's shift our focus to the hills of Uttarakhand. A small town of the hill state, Joshimath, was struck by a tragedy this month. The hill under it is subsiding and residents are being relocated. Joshimath also serves as the gateway to Badrinath, one of the four pilgrimages in Chardham Yatra. Our next report tells more about this pilgrimage.
Joshimath, a small town nestled in the slopes of Himalayas, has caught the country's attention overnight. The hill, on which most of the town is pinned, has been subsiding. The occurrence gathered pace a few days ago, leaving cracks on the walls, roofs and roads. Efforts are on to rehabilitate those affected by this tragedy and find answers to what led to this disaster. Joshimath is important in various ways. It is not just a tourism destination, but a gateway to Badrinath as well as Hemkund Sahib, two important religious places of worship. Pilgrims stay in the town before heading to the last leg of the Chardham Yatra to Badrinath. But the town is in danger and on the brink of collapse, and there is a possibility that the last stop in the Yatra might get cut off, at least temporarily. But what is this Chardham Yatra, let us understand. The Yatra is an annual tour of the four Hindu shrines, Yamunotri, Gangotri, Kedarnath and Badrinath. All of these are located in Uttarakhand. The pilgrims visit all four places one by one in a clockwise direction, starting from Yamunotri, then Gangotri, Kedarnath and lastly Badrinath. Himkund Sahib, one of the most sacred sites for Sikhs, is connected to the Chardham Yatra. Besides religious significance, the Yatra plays a big part in boosting Uttarakhand's economy. According to reports, it brings around 7,500 crore rupees to Uttarakhand annually. It gives employment to over 1 million people in various sectors like hospitality, handicraft and priests. The Yatra could not take place for 2 years in 2020 and 21 due to COVID-19 pandemic. In 2022, it resumed on May 3rd on the occasion of Akshaya Tritiya. According to official data, it registered the highest ever footfall in 2022. Over 4 million people participated in the Yatra. Compared to the pre-pandemic numbers, this is a jump of 35%. This year, the Yatra is scheduled to start on April 22nd. The Yatra received significant help from the state government and the center. Since the 2013 floods, the state has invested 1,000 crore rupees to redevelop the Kedarnath Shrine. 550 crore have also been allocated for the facelift of Badrinath Temple. The center is also undertaking several infrastructure projects to improve the connectivity between the four sites. The Rail Vikas Nigam Limited is working on the Chardham Railway Line at the cost of 73,000 crore rupees. The Road Ministry is constructing an 889 km long highway connecting the four sites with a total cost of 9,500 crore rupees. NTPC is also constructing one of its biggest power plants, NTPC Tapovan Vishnugarh Hydroelectric Project near Joshimath.
Nation's trusted bank, SBI, the banker to every Indian.
Activists have argued that the infra projects in the region are responsible for deteriorating the ecology and played a role in the Joshimath tragedy. The center has, however, argued that they are keeping all the measures in mind to protect the area's biodiversity. Well, that's all we have for you today. We will be back with more news and analysis in our next episode. Stay tuned. Thank you for watching.
For more news, views and updates, subscribe to Business Standard on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast and Spotify. Also follow us on YouTube, Vimeo, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook and LinkedIn.